Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
Hey everybody, welcome to Metallicast, the Metallica podcast. This is part four of Metallicast Black Summer, my 10-week chronological track-by-track breakdown of the classic Black album. Since we are going chronologically and this is part four, we are obviously looking at track four, a true Metallica classic, The Unforgiven. And to help me talk about this classic track, a man who I call the master of collections, Mr. Brian Silver. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back. Thrilled to get to talk about the Black Album.
Absolutely. Now, last time you were here, it was on episode 19. So if anybody missed that episode, check it out. Brian came on and talked about his one-of-a-kind, Hall of Fame-worthy Metallica collection. Has a lot of cool items, a lot of cool stories. So go back to episode 19 and check that out if you've not already done so. But today, Brian is not here to talk about his collection as much as he is to talk about just Metallica in general and nerd out with me.
Yes. I love this. This is my favorite thing to do.
So if I recall from the last time you were on the show, your entry point for Metallica was Injustice for All, correct?
Correct. It was actually Injustice for All during the Black Album era. So those two worlds collided really fast once I got into Metallica.
So that is very interesting. So how did you get... I mean, when the Black Album came out, it was sort of everywhere, I feel like. You know, Enter Sandman was on MTV. It was being played on FM rock radio. So when the Black Album's out, how is Injustice for All sort of your entry point during all that phenomenon that's going on with the Black Album?
You know, I think it was probably my age. You know, I was probably 13 years old or something. And, you know, I was never exposed to Metallica before then. And so I think that just the first thing that I heard from my friend's brother or at my friend's house was his brother's tape, his Injustice for All tape. And it just happened to be during that 92, you know, probably about 1992 when I got it. But it was like, here, listen to this, you know, right, Harvester 1. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, by the way, have you heard Enter Sandman? You know, and then have you heard, you know, have you heard Nothing Else Matters? And, that was quick. And then not too long after that, I just remember watching a year and a half of the life of Metallica over and over and over and over again.
You know? Such a great time capsule of the band, a year and a half in the life of his.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing about something like that, too, is I just feel like people don't do that anymore because they don't have to because of the internet. And that was such a, like, as a fan, I remember that movie was such a look into the band and the recording process. And, you know, like you felt like you were part of Metallica and that was the only way you had that. So, I mean, that was such a treasure for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for Hardwired Self-Destruct, it was cool because, like, little by little, Metallica released the making of that album online. If memory serves me correctly, I think they did the same thing for Death Magnetic. It was sort of like a track-by-track making of. And, you know, like you said, with the internet the way it is, you can just do that and release it everywhere. But it's really cool to have, like, a cohesive package like we have for Year and a Half Life, especially since this is such a, you know, no disrespect to Death Magnetic and Hardwired, but they are no Black Album because not many things are. It's such a unique monster of an album and such a huge part of their history. I mean, it's the biggest thing they've ever done. So the biggest part of their history in a lot of ways. So it's really cool time capsule that period. So if anybody's not seen it for whatever reason, check it out. You know, I'm sure it's online and you can definitely get it on Metallica.com. I still have my VHSs dug away somewhere, so I have to
update. Me too. Me too. And I would just add that if you have not seen A Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica at this point and you're listening to this podcast, turn it off because you're not a real fan. So for those of you, goodbye.
Love it.
Everybody else, let's have a good conversation.
I mean, it's hard to disagree with that. So, so when you listen to Harvester of Sorrow, then, I mean, so first of all, that makes a lot of sense, you know, because, I mean, I'm younger, so my entry point was the Black Album, but I was so young when I heard it that the next album I really got into them, got into by Metallica was Load. And then I was like, oh, they have four other albums, you know, so because of my right. age, I had to backtrack and discover the whole back catalog and kind of educate myself. And I would just grab, I mean, this was pre-internet, so I would just grab every Metallica-related book, magazine, anything I can get my hands on, and just dive headfirst into educate myself about the history of this band and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, I feel like for me, it was easy to digest an album like Load because my entry point was the Black Album, so it was already a little bit more commercial sounding than Streetblind. I was so young and so naive and so innocent. So perhaps for you it was the same result, but I mean, if you hear a song like Harvester of Sorrow or Dyer's Eve, and then you hear Nothing Else Matters, was that like a stark contrast for you, or were you just sort of young enough where you're just sort of like, oh, this is all cool?
No, you know what? I was so young at the time that, and I've been playing drums at that point for like 2 years in my life, and you know, what got me into Justice was listening to that, you know, those drums. And crazy enough to think that I remember the Rolling Stones at that point put Lars Ulrich as one of the world's best drummers. And nowadays people laugh at him being in the top 100. But that album put him up there, right? I mean,
right.
what he did with double bass was, you know, that revolutionized, you know, the drumming as we know it. So that's what got me, you know, that's why Justice was such an easy attraction. But much like you, because of my age, I then went forward in the catalog. So right. I went right into, you know, the Black Album and Load with you. And then you too, I actually later had to go backwards like that, you know? So, you know, I probably have more memories with Metallica from the time they cut their hair with Load after than I do remember from the time I heard Justice and the Black Album, because those times came so fast, you know. But
right.
the thing about the Black Album was it was just from start to finish was like everything you wanted in music. It was hard, it was soft, there were easy drum parts, there were some hard drum parts for a 13-14 year old kid at that time, and that's what the attraction was, you know. So and coincidentally enough, that was the start of Unforgiven, which brings us back to the conversation, which then spawned off, you know, multiple versions of it, which I think could be a conversation for a later day. But we can always talk about 2 and 3 right now. But I just think that the piece of the Unforgiven, it's a good plateau because it takes the hard and it takes the soft of that album and combines it into one. And I think that's why it's such a big success for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that make the Black Album successful. It was, you know, great production. The album just has such an amazing sound to it. To this day, it holds up. The songs are there, you know, riff-wise, lyric-wise. Everything was in place for mass appeal, right? Like, the diehard hardcore metalheads. I mean, I've talked in the first 3 episodes how there's a certain level metalhead who was like, oh, they sold out. Or, you know, the same thing I've been hearing since they released Fade to Black. But there's something there for the hardcore metalhead. There's something there for the, you know, the high school football player who's never heard of this band ever. There's something there for the cheerleader. Like, all like the high school cliches. There was something there for everybody in all those different groups, which made this such a monster album. And just to backtrack a little bit, obviously, Enter Sandman was the first single, but The Unforgiven was the second single. So for some people, this could have been the first Metallica song they've ever heard. And like you said, the overall Black Album finds a balance between what I would call old school Metallica, you know, a song like Holier Than Thou that I discussed in part 3 with Jason Long was or sorry, with Richard S. He was, you know, a great balance of kind of doing a more streamlined, less progressive, more, dare I say, commercial sounding thrash song, even though it's, I mean, commercial and thrash, just those two words together just sort of clash. But, but like you say, The Unforgiven was another perfect balance. You had the heavy, you had the melodic, and they, but both the heavy parts and the melodic parts were different than sort of anything Metallica had done previously. And at the time, I feel like this was a really unique song, not only in their catalog, but in the metal genre as a whole.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, James Hetfield actually sings, you know, and I remember there's parts throughout A Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica where, you know, Bob Rock is returning the reel and, you know, they're going up pitches and singing in octaves and he's, you know, so dumb, you know, he's over and over again. I remember they're talking about delivery and all, and that was real singing. That was before Nothing Else Matters singing. Cause like you said, this is the second single off the Black Album. So, you know, I think it's so interesting. And, you know, we were talking about you mentioned the combination of it being a soft song that goes into a hard song. In fact, I queued up the very thing on the Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica that made me really like the song, The Unforgiven. And I actually, when I first heard it, I liked it, but there were things I liked better in it. You know, I love Struggle Within. Like, I played that over and over and over again. That was my song. But watching A Year and a Half on a Life, there's a part 45 minutes into it, and they're going through sounds, and I hear James play this heavy, heavy riff that was somewhere in the Unforgiven, but I didn't hear it at first, and so I'll play it for you, and then we'll see if we remember where we are. So this part right here, this is what really turned me on to this set.
Right.
So if you remember that part, when I heard that, you know, when James was playing that riff in A Year and a Half, I was like, fuck, that's awesome. And and that's the riff that's being played underneath the solo.
Right.
And that was when I was like, this is really heavy. This is really heavy because you hear that heavy ass riff, you know, on top of it, you're hearing a mix of acoustic guitars and all this stuff. But that was, like you said, that made the song to me the ultimate combination. And it sounds small and pathetic, but that was this piece that just really drove this song home for me. And so, you know, I'm at a point, what's hard for me, and this is probably a question that would come up at some point in this conversation, is I love this song so much on an album, but I really don't like hearing it in concert. And that's hard because musically I love this song. All the parts of it, I love this song live for the most part. But I just, you know, I think that there's something with, you know, the acoustic verse when you're in a concert that slows down tremendously. Lars, of course, drags a little bit. And for me, I've actually lost a little love for this song because I've heard it live so many times.
All right. So you brought up a lot of awesome points. And I want, so at some point I'm going to backtrack because I want to dive into some of the points you made in a little bit more detail. But let's talk about them playing this song live. Since that's where we left off of. Because I made an interesting note here. You know, if you recall, The Unforgiven was pretty much played throughout the entire Black Album tour. Mm-hmm. But there was a large chunk of time where this song was sort of abandoned. During the Load, Reload era, like pretty much for the second half of the 90s and early 2000s, there was a good maybe 10-year span where this song was performed a handful of times at most. And it was not really until the World Magnetic Tour where they started kind of pulling it back out. And I've said this before, but what's really cool about Metallica.com, if you're a nerd like us, is that you can go to the song section of the website and they have like all, not only do they have the lyrics and the videos and all that great stuff, but they have all the live stats. So, I mean, if you think of the other quote-unquote hits from the Black Album, like Enter Sandman, I forget the exact number off the top of my head, but it's been performed.
It's like 1900 times or something.
Yeah. It's between like 13 and like 1700 or something like that, you know, and same thing with Sad But True. But do you want to take a guess as to how many times The Unforgiven's been performed live?
Since you set it up like that, like I would guess 200 times.
It's more than that, but not drastically more. 484 times.
Really?
And I mean, think of it. This is one of the biggest hits off the biggest album of their career. And since 1991, when the album came out, they've only played it 484 times, which is pretty spectacular when you think about it.
Sure, yeah.
So I wonder, I remember reading an interview, I could not tell you where, and I'm completely paraphrasing here, but I believe it was Hetfield who said, you know, the song was just sort of difficult to pull off live, probably because he has the dual guitar and there's a lot of dynamic stuff happening. But I wonder if part of it was maybe they felt like it just related to your point, maybe did not vibe with other songs as well. Right. I think the placement of the Unforgiven, I like it live, but I think the placement of it is very important, more so than like another quote ballad in their catalog, like a Fade to Black or Welcome Home Sanitarium, because the difference is, and this was a clear intentional difference, was that, you know, when you listen to Fade to Black, when you listen to Sanitarium, when you listen to One, those are songs that start off like with clean guitar, melodic vocals, but they build and they build and they build and they have those epic heavy choruses, and then they have those long sprawling thrash solo sections. Like, it's just a tornado of sound by the end. Whereas the Unforgiven is the opposite, right? It starts heavy, it goes melodic, and while it has that great heavy part that we just heard from A Year and a Half Life Metallica with an amazing solo over, but we'll get to that later. It's not the same roller coaster, if you will, that those songs have. And when you look at the other ballads that followed, you know, I mean, the ballads like The Day That Never Comes is more in line with what we saw in the 80s. Even A Halo on Fire is not even like a true ballad, but it's probably the closest we have on that album, right? But that's more in line with what they did with the 80s. And then the Load and Reload stuff is just sort of a beast of their own.
Right, and they never get played. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but I think there's a lot of good songs that should be played in there. And, you know, I think that, you know, I think part of the problem is Metallica is still on these big stadium tours, right? And you got to play Unforgiven right now. And so, you know, if you've got a Black album touring around, you guarantee yourself that you're going to see the Unforgiven pretty much just about every night, as much as you're going to see Sandman at this point.
Right.
You know, so, you know, we got to get, I guess the whole thing is let's protest and get back to those, you know, early 2000, late 90s shows and things like that, where they change the set list every night, but that's a whole different thing.
Well,
I understand, man, 1,336 times.
There you go. So, I mean, I think related to your last point, too, two points. When they play in a stadium, you're going to have more casual people there, right? So they're more likely to play the quote-unquote hits than they're still pulling out deep cuts, but they're not going to mix it up as much as they would when it's, you know, half the audience size and it's more of their hardcore fan base.
Absolutely.
But I would say the pro of them not playing a different set every single night is that I do think you get a overall tighter show. I think the band right now is playing some of the best live shows I've ever seen them play from a musical standpoint. In terms of the quality of James' vocals and just the tightness of the band. And when you are doing a different set every night, that you lose some of that tightness. But also, on the flip side, there's a really cool just rock and roll element to that, right? That keeps it loose and keeps it like this whole train could go off the track at any time. And I kind of like that too. So
Right. But there's also no alcohol involved anymore with James, so it's a little different. It doesn't go off the track that much anymore.
Yeah.
So.
To dig a little deeper into, you made a really good point about Hetfield and his singing voice on this song. And I've talked with other people who've been on the last few episodes about Bob Rock. And for the Black Album, for all intents and purposes, you have to talk about Bob Rock as if he was the fifth member of Metallica.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had them doing things that nobody else had them do. And, you know, they were with Fleming for a couple albums before that, and he just took them to a space that they had never been. He is absolutely part of the success of the Black Album. I think the only thing that you can blame Bob Rock for is a bad snare drum sound and Saint Anger, because everything else has a time and a reason, honestly. But the Black Album obviously was the top of that game, and
yeah,
they were at a point in their career where everything was flowing. And so, yeah, Bob Rock's the man. And I mean, I think from listening to A Year and a Half in Life of Metallica and watching other interviews, with the exception of Kirk's solo that he literally just, you know, practiced, knew what he wanted and went for it, Bob Rock had his hand in every part of this album.
Absolutely. And specifically to the vocals, we've seen Hetfield sing, but not like he does here. This is when we really hear him sing for the first time, and this is something too we can I'll definitely explore more in the Nothing Else Matters episode. But the Unforgiven, sort of the first introduction of like, oh, it's right. Not just that signature Hetfield bark and snarl and growl. He's like you said before, there's harmonies, there's this I found this quote from Dave Mustaine.
Oh boy.
Ooh, ah! That's my Dave Mustaine. So this is a quote he gave to Revolver magazine, and he says, "I remember hearing this song when I was talking to Lars Ulrich once and telling him this is my favorite song off the Black record. And he goes, really? Fuck, man. It was The Unforgiven. I liked it because I thought this was really the first time I've ever really heard James Hetfield sing. He had sung before and he was a great singer, but that was the first time I ever heard him really, really sing." And, you know, and I feel like there's this overall warmth to the vocals that we had just never really heard from Hetfield before. You kind of expect the singing voice to be big sound. You kind of expect it to be deep, and I think we get that. But it has this unexpected warmth to it. And again, I feel like when we talked about balance before, I feel like the Black Album perhaps has the best balance of both Hetfields. The bark Hetfield and the singing Hetfield.
And the singing Hetfield, right.
Right.
I mean, right. And I think that's really learned. That's how he learned to actually sing. I mean, people blame Bob Rock for blowing Hetfield's voice out. But at the same time, you've also got to give Bob Rock all the credit in the world for giving James Hetfield a singing voice, because that was when he actually was singing. And I'm not, no disrespect, I love James and I love his singing, but that was, you know, that's like fifth grade choir type of shit that they were doing to James's voice then.
Yeah. I mean, this is when James Hetfield went from being the vocalist of Metallica to being a true vocalist.
Right. Absolutely.
He learned about his voice. He learned what went into doing his voice. And when you mentioned his voice getting blown out, and, you know, he had to take singing lessons. And, you know, now it's you see these videos of him. He's doing, you know, vocal warm-up, something he did not do prior to the Black Album. But, and I think that's why since the Black Album, you know, during Load and Reload, you hear his singing voice has grown even more so. He lost a little bit of that bark and snarl and growl, and I think that's some of the, what the Metallica haters like to comment on.
Yeah,
but sure. His overall singing voice, progresses during that era. And now I feel like on an album like Hardwire Self-Destruct, he sort of, again, found a good balance. And his voice has progressed even more so. But the Black One was really the first time where it was like, I'm going to give you the Hetfield that you know, but I'm going to give you this other side of me that you've never, ever heard before.
Right, right. Just going to show you how fucking awesome I am anyways. Yeah. You know?
Right.
That's what it is. That's what it is. Yeah, I mean, there's so much great from James in there, you know, from his singing. I mean, talk about his guitar playing in that too. I mean, you know, that's some fucking awesome riffs in there. And even... Yeah. Even Lars's drum fill, you know, where he's going, you know, from his, you know, tom to a snare to a bass, that triplet is a really cool thing. And so, I mean, the whole song has such elements that, you know, you have to love it. It's a type of song where, you know, a guy can walk down the aisle to it, and then at the same time he can be throwing his friends into a wall with excitement because it gets hard and heavy, you know?
Well, it's so funny. Like, I guess I got to eat my words a little bit because I said it does not really build up. And that's a lie. It does not build up the same way as the previous battles we've heard on the, you know, on Ride the Lightning and Master Puppets sure. and Just for All. But it has its own, that bridge section and it like build, it's a short guitar part that just is building up as if it's ready to explode, and then Kirk Hammett just rips into it, and it truly feels like it's exploding. And I want to talk about this guitar solo. We've mentioned a year and a half in the life of there's that, and you briefly mentioned the scene, but there's that what I'll call a famous scene. You know, Lars Ulrich is notoriously coaches Kirk Hammett when, you know, during his guitar solos, at least during this time period. And Bob Rock is just nitpicking Kirk. No, and Kirk comes in with all these ideas. And, you know, if you read interviews from him, he wanted to do kind of a more complex, more progressive soul than what ended up on the record. And then Bob Rock delivers that famous line. Do you know what I'm going to say?
Go for it. You know it.
Let me hear that guitar player of the year solo.
Right?
Right? Right? And then he goes, all right, just go for it.
You want to fucking go for it? Fucking go for it.
Exactly.
All right? Here it is.
And that is the amazing part about seeing that scene unravel is then Kirk plays the Unforgiven solo pretty much as you hear it from the record.
On video. Right. It's unbelievable.
Like, it's such a natural, magical moment.
You know, like, it's like crackle, boom, da-da-doo-doo, da-da-doo-doo. You know, it's fucking... You know what I mean? It's like it should play off what's there. Going up high, it's just like...
I guess what I'm just trying to say, he starts up there and then goes down, and all the shit you said right there is great shit, but I don't see it being any less great if it comes in bar two instead of in bar one.
But what I'm saying is build rather than blow your load, bring everybody down, and then build it up again. I'm just saying let's fucking... get guttural and build it to a peak, because that's why there's the strings and all those changes at the end.
Why can't it start here and go like that?
Yeah, that's my school of thought. Grab them and like take them to this other place and then really take them to a higher plateau. Fuck, man, sound new age.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Impress me.
Mm-hmm. God has permission.
Do whatever you want, Kirk. And you agree with him? Go for it, man.
Well, come on, let's cut the shit and start working.
Cut to the chase and fucking play, okay?
All right, man.
Now that you've, you know, warmed up, mm-hmm. Let's hear the fucking Guitar Player of the Year solo. Okay.
It's pretty much the type of guitar solo I've been trying to do for the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm really proud of that.
And Kirk Hammett has gone on record as saying not too long ago that this is his favorite solo. I have a quote from him that says, I was thinking about the solo in The Unforgiven. I remember showing up to the studio that morning. He was going to play all these certain licks. Then Bob Rock's going, that's fucking crap. Then it was one of the very first times when I said, just fucking hit the record button and shit flowed out. I prefer to record my solos that way now because I like the spontaneity of it. That's how that solo is pretty much created.
Right. I mean, that's everything about it's amazing, you know? And
yeah,
it's Kirk. It's that my opinion is a perfect guitar solo for me. That is,
I 100% agree. This is my favorite Kirk Hammett guitar solo.
Yeah. Yeah. When you listen to Kirk's solos, and I love all those solos, you know, they almost sound like at some point they could have just been made up partway through it. And this one is, it's thought out, you know. I mean, from that way that he slides down to the very beginning of it, you know, just,
yeah.
And the whole thing is just perfect. And the, you know, the barring of the chord up to, you know, the fingers running up and down. Yeah. It's incredible. It really is.
Yeah. In my notes, I said it lacks the complexity and technicality of some of his other solos that came before, but this solo is just so immediate in your face, but at the same time, super melodic and catchy. Like, how many guitar solos do you hear that you really want to sing along with and you feel the need to sing along with? That's how catchy this solo is. And I wrote, same thing as you, I wrote, it is a fully thought out solo.
Like you said, I mean, look, he was doing solos on Kill 'Em All. They're 3-4 times as fast. I get that, you know, he was 19 years old then. But that's not what this is. This is so much more than that. It's funny that you say sing along because it's at a Metallica concert. You're right. It's just like lyrics, you know. Well, everybody's doing that stuff.
Right. This is the ultimate air guitar solo.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the ultimate rock star solo.
It's the fucking guitar player of the year's solo. So, like, you got to respect it.
Right. Yeah. And I made a note too, you know, like the haters out there, they love to point out his overuse of the wah pedal. And of course, he always gets the Mustaine comparisons because of the history there. And you know what? Dave Mustaine might be a better technical player, or at least more progressive and flashy. And compared, and when you look at what, at least the solos that they both typically play.
But, absolutely.
But I think Kirk Hammett, similar to the conversation we had about James' vocals, I'm going to use that word again, balance. He finds a perfect balance. He can do fast, rip-your-face-off solos, right? They call him the Ripper for a reason. But just also at the same time, super melodic, and generally they're solos that you can sing along with. They are part, they feel like part of the song more so than like something that's happening over the song.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's its own. I mean, you say it great here. You really do. And I'm not trying to just agree, but it's what you said is so true. Is there's depth and changes amongst the guitar solos. And it's not just, you know, power chords over it. There's thoughtful stuff like I played before underneath it that are different parts of the song. And that didn't happen a lot in the other albums. There's just more complexity to this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely, we have to also touch upon, the lyrics of The Unforgiven. Again, I think these are some of my favorite ever from Hetfield. He has gone on record of saying, he has said it multiple times, but, have you ever seen the documentary Absent that he was a part of?
Yep, I did.
So that is a really interesting segment of him. So I might have mentioned this on a previous episode at some point, but for those of you who have no clue what I'm talking about, because it's not a Metallica documentary, but basically Absent is a doc about different individuals who had absentee fathers and their personal story. And the movie ends, I would say, with about a 15-minute segment interview with Hetfield. And it's a really, really intriguing 15 minutes because not only is he going to, not only is he very open about his childhood and his things that he went through, but it makes great parallels with his lyrics. And, you know, what I think that what I love most about modern day Hetfield is that he has become way more open with about the things that he writes. I know, like, during the Black Album era, if he was asked about a lyric, he'd be like, fuck you.
Yeah, you're right. Now he digs into his soul and tells you about it. You know, now,
yeah.
Next he knows he can play the Unforgiven's about his grandfather named Frank, who, you know, did this and this. Before, I'd be like, fuck the old fucking The Unforgiven.
Yeah. And, but he said they asked, they look at part of the lyrics related to his childhood. So they look, you know, they share some of Dyer's Eve. They share some of The God That Failed. But they ask him, what is the most personal song you ever written? And without hesitation, he goes, The Unforgiven.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really break down the lyrics, you can start seeing, knowing his story, you know, the parallels of it.
Totally.
You know, new blood joins this earth and quickly he's subdued. Through constant pain, disgrace, the young boy learns their rules. Growing up in this strict Christian Science household, and just feeling like he was kind of, to quote another band, a slave to the grind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that verse, and then the other one that, you know, that gets me a lot is, you know, halfway through the song, they dedicate their lives to running all of his. He tried to please them all, this bitter man he is.
Yeah.
You know, then he says throughout his life that the same he's battled constantly, this fight he cannot win, the tired man they see no longer cares. You know, I mean, it's just, it's fucked up, right? You know, it's fucked up. And to me, you know, the other lyric that I really love, which is so simple, is I love the lyric, you labeled me, I'll label you. You know, it's kind of that an eye for an eye type of attitude that Hetfield had back then too, you know, and that's, you know, you judge me, I'm going to judge you. And that's right. Heavy. And that's, you know, everybody talks about that wall that James Hetfield built around him and frankly still has to this day, you know, and I mean, that's pretty, you know, that's pretty hardcore, you know, you label me, I'll label you. And I just think it's incredible.
Right. And, just as kind of a throwaway, I always love the line to never shine through in what I've shown. I think that's a great line. But one of my other favorite things about these lyrics is Hetfield does, I call it one of his tricks, where, you know, we've seen it in a number of songs. We saw it in Injustice for All, you know. We see it in Am I Savage, where he turns things around and reveals it's him or it's us,
uh-huh.
Right? Sure. And I think perhaps The Unforgiven does it the best, you know, to die regretfully, that old man here is me. And it's sort of, you can kind of see too, in retrospect, he's probably talking about his father and now he's seeing himself.
For sure.
You know, he's seeing his father in himself.
Yeah. And it's funny because you and I have never discussed this before. And that's always been kind of my thought is it's him seeing his dad, you know. I think I tie his dad to this song quickly because that was also when probably the first and only time I ever saw Virgil Hetfield was on A Year and a Half when they're talking about The Unforgiven. Yeah. So I've always thrown that assimilation of the song with him. And then, like you said, I really feel that's it, you know, that's his, you know, his hatred and, you know, right there for his dad. If you haven't seen the movie, you've got to see it because it will really help you understand James Hetfield.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think, you know, it's what would be really interesting to do is watch at the very least part one of A Year and a Half, which is about the recording of the Black Album. and then follow that up with the classic albums documentary, which was done in, Jason Newsted was still in the band, so it must have been like 99 or 2000.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
I think that's like a cool sequel because it's almost like 10 years later in the band, you know, reflecting back. So it's kind of cool to have both those as like parallels of each other. But yeah, I mean, this is, you know, you can go back in the catalog and see, you know, Hatfield writing at, you know, as third person or about somebody kind of about a different character. And in retrospect, like, oh, he was singing about himself, whether he knew it or not, like in Master of Puppets, when he's talking about addiction, Dyer's Eve, but this is really the album where he's finally singing about about me, and looking inward. And The Unforgiven, I think, is, you know, along with Nothing Else Matters and along with The God That Failed, those are probably the three best examples of him really just breaking himself down for the first time.
Sure. Yeah. And one more reason why this whole album, you know, is crazy. And like you said, breaking himself down, that's what this is all about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that we would continue seeing him explore, right? On Load with tracks like Bleeding Me and, you know, and so on and so forth and on the following albums. It's funny because as I'm speaking, I was thinking, you know, there are sequels to the song, right? There's The Unforgiven 2. There's The Unforgiven 3. But when you look lyrically, a song like Am I Savage could even be a sequel to The Unforgiven lyrically, talking about, you
sure, know, talking about himself.
Right. Now, he's not only, you know, The Unforgiven, he's seeing his father and himself. And in Am I Savage, he's seeing his father and himself, and now he's seeing it in his son.
Right, right. It's really interesting.
Yeah, so it's like these themes have followed him, you know, in his songs on and off, but since really the Black Album. And this song was just such a great exploration of that side of him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's great points about the lyrics.
And one more point I'll make lyrically, and I do not want to go deep into the sequels because I feel like, you know, like you mentioned before, that's a whole separate conversation to be had. But the way I look at it is, if The Unforgiven 1 is about kind of childhood, The Unforgiven 2 is maybe more about like adult relationships, and The Unforgiven 3 is more just about your relationship with yourself.
Heavy. I've never come to my own personal conclusion of if naming the songs The Unforgiven 2 and Unforgiven 3 made sense, or if they should have stood on their own. But I, you know, there's got to be a reason, and that might be the reason that it's done that way. Is there's got to be a reason that the band named it 2 and 3, and maybe the lyrics follow it, like you suggest.
Well, I think the most interesting example of that too is Unforgiven 3, because Unforgiven 2, you know, has like the same chord progression, and it has more of like a you know, it has more of like a country western twang, and it follows a similar lyrical theme and pattern, and it really sounds, if they did not call that The Unforgiven 2 and release it on a record, I feel like people would be like, oh, what is this? The Unforgiven 2? Like,
right,
it sounds...
Right, exactly. You know,
they're so similar. But The Unforgiven 3 is really unique because that really is, like, such a drastically different sounding song than the first two. And, I mean, down to where they do not even include, like, the horn intro or anything, really, to connect. It's just the overall kind of lyrical theme of forgiveness or not being forgiven.
Not being forgiven.
By the way, the horn intro, I remember seeing, I think it was in the Classic Albums documentary, you know, they play it, the horn intro was sampled from somewhere, they reversed it, and they did not reveal it on that documentary for like kind of joking around for legal reasons, but legitimately for legal reasons also. And I've been trying to figure out where it's from. I've heard it's definitely from a Western movie, I think, but I've read it's from The Unforgiven, the movie. I've read it's from A Fistful of Dollars, and then I've read it's from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and all those make sense. I know Hatfield's is a huge Clint Eastwood fan and all that, but do you know where definitively where the horn was lifted from?
No, I heard originally it was from The Unforgiven, but I thought that was just a joke. And then to hear you rattle off the other ones made me realize, you know, it's definitely not that, and that's just part of the story. But I never had that confirmed or denied. But that would be, I guess, a great piece of Metallica trivia. If anybody knows the answer to that, I would love to know that too.
Right? Yeah. If you know, then please let us know on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or wherever.
Tell us. Or your new chat.
For the love of God. Yes, thank you for mentioning the chat. We're a small group, but we're a tight-knit group. So Brian is part of it. Richard, who you heard in the last episode, is part of it. Flick Chat, it's a free app. I'm not sponsored by them. I'm not making a penny off this. I just think it's a cool thing. It's basically an app designed to chat about your favorite podcast. But, you know, we talk a little bit about Metallicast, but it's really just a general Metallica conversation. And I'm open to talking about metal and music in general. And, yeah, we can do that on other forms of social media, but this is just a little bit more streamlined. And it's, you don't have like any character limits like you do on Twitter. It's a completely free app. If you download it on your phone and you just search Metallicast, the group will pop up and you can join. And we have only a handful of members, but we've been making good use of it, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a fun group, so sign up for it. And just so you know, to keep my facts going, I did pull it up, and James confirmed in the documentary Classic Albums that it is, in fact, taken from The Unforgiven.
Oh, there you go. It's funny because I was trying to think back to that documentary because I know he talks about it, but I felt like he like danced around it and did not directly reveal. But maybe he does.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but there's the information right there. So we'll stick with it.
The more you know.
The more you know.
I think, too, we should mention the music video related to the song. Because for me, and maybe this is just my entry point into the band, but if I had to say the top three most recognizable Metallica videos, it would go in order one, then Enter Sandman, then this, which is ironically the first three videos that they did. So maybe that has something to do with it as well. But I think this is definitely one of their more iconic videos.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, I think as a kid, I didn't like this video only because in every video I wanted to see a drum set because I was, you know, yeah. I didn't have my drum set yet. So I just wanted to watch Lars play the drums.
Yeah.
You know, so I really loved like the Sabbath True video. I even liked the Sandman video because they had the strobe of drums coming in there. But, you know, when you think of the overall story that's being told in relationship to the song, obviously this is the best one for a million different reasons.
Yeah. You really see the child trapped in a room. He's kind of carving away at the wall, carving like a square in the wall, looking, he's trying to escape. And you see him become like middle-aged and then just a very elderly man. Then the hole opens up, and once he can be free, the elderly man lies down, and he assume passes.
And then he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's heavy shit, right? I mean.
I know. I was just going to say, we got a little deeper on this episode than I thought we might.
That's heavy shit, but it's true. You know, in preparation for talking with you tonight, I listened to the song a bunch. You know, yeah. I didn't really look up too many facts or anything like that because I wanted to really get into the emotion and rawness of the song. But, I mean, the more we talk about it, the more you think of how fucked up a lot of it is. You know, I mean, it's heavy. Yeah. It is heavy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's so many people like it for the musical content that you and I were talking about in the beginning and the progression that it does. But, you know, it's, you hit it. It's heavy fucking lyrics, and it's, that's one of the things that makes it such a good song.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, related to that point, it's one of those songs that you've heard so many times that you, it's so easy to sing the words and no longer think about what those words mean.
Right? Absolutely. Exactly.
And the message, the meaning of the song gets lost a lot of times because you're just like, yeah, Unforgiven. Fuck yeah. The song rules.
Right. Right. And you're absolutely right. And I think that I'm in that area right now. Like I was saying, I was bashing it a little bit when I see it on tour because of that. You sing it, you get through it. It's like, it's a good time to catch your breath and stretch your knees, but you don't think about what the lyrics are in the song and the reasons I used to rewind it on tape over and over and over and start it again.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So
are we forgetting anything about The Unforgiven, Brian, that we should mention before this episode wraps up?
I think that the Hetfield guitar, the acoustic that he uses is really fucking cool. If you haven't seen that, it's got that like etched in flames, but I think that listen to this podcast and then go back and listen to the song. And it's interesting because I'm as much listening to you tonight as probably the people listening to the conversation, because I'm thinking of the song in a different way because of what we've said. And I think that that's what's the mind fuck of Unforgiven. So it's thank you for making me think more, you know, about the deepness of this tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. I did not know I was going to have that effect on you, Mr. Silver.
It's great. It's great.
But that's why, honestly, though, all joking, that's why I think it's cool to have these conversations, because there's been so many times where, like, for example, last episode, we're talking about Holier Than Thou, and I like the song. I like every song on the Black Album, but for me, that's a weaker song off the album. But then, you know, I'll read what people are saying about it, and that's a real big fan favorite. A lot of people love that. And then hearing what Richard had to say about it, I walked away from that episode like, oh, yeah, that song is really badass.
Right. Right. And I like that song more now. And I think I go back to, you hit it on the head with these, and it's all the Black Album songs, including Sandman is, you know, you just hear them and you sing them. It's like you're going through the motions with them, and there's not as much.
Yeah.
You know, there's, maybe it's just me, but there's not as much connection to me when they play these live, because I've heard them a million times in my car. So it's like, you just don't get quite as jazzed up for these ones you hear regularly, because it's the fucking Black Album. It's the greatest, you know, hard rock / heavy metal album, you know, known to man, you know, outside of Jethro Tull, which is a joke. And so I think that's why it is. And it's been played so long to this day, it's still played so often that it's just, like you said, it's more of a sing-along as opposed to, fuck yeah, they're playing this song right now.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I literally grew up with this song. I mean, my introduction to this album only existed because I have two older brothers, and MTV would be on the background, you know, and they'd be listening to, I had one bro who's, you know, got really into grunge and rock in general. So like all this stuff would be sort of like playing in the background. So I just remember being like in first grade and absorbing Enter Sandman. And then I remember elementary school, like borrowing cassette from my neighbor, and I recorded on the Black onto a blank cassette. And I remember that Don't Tread on Me, which was the last song on side A, was cut off. And Struggle Within was also cut off, because that was the last song on side B. So then I had to go out and buy the actual cassette so I could have the full album. I mean, I bring that up because I remember going, you know, I remember just having that cassette in my Walkman, headphones on, and just absorbing that album from like elementary school on.
And so over and over.
Yeah. I have heard that album. I could not even imagine to count, like even start to count or guess. But I mean, if you told me I listened to it a billion times. I'd be like, oh, that's probably right. I mean, so relating to your point, I mean, those songs are just part of my DNA now, I feel like.
Right.
You know, yeah. So like I don't even think about that context. And part of the reason why I love the Black One is that it has a personal connection to me because it was my introduction to the band and I have like all those childhood memories. So it's like I have an emotional connection to it in that right, way. Total. But I right. don't really have an emotional connection to the songs as much as I do on other Metallica albums, because to me they're just kind of more surface level because I was young when I heard them, and I just absorb them like a sponge, and they're just part of me. I don't really yeah. internalize them much, except when I do right. something like this and I really start going to detail about a specific thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you 1,000,000%. Point well said.
Whew, this was fun, Brian.
This was intense, man. I need to go cleanse.
I don't smoke, but I need a cigarette and a shower, I think.
No, this is, look, I mean, there's about 3 people in the world that I can have this conversation with, and you're one of them. So I appreciate you giving me the time to talk about this. This is awesome. The if you haven't watched any of the episodes leading up to it, I mean, you know, when you talk about songs like Holier, everybody has an opinion, and I think when it comes to a song like The Unforgiven, literally everybody has an opinion, whether they're Metallica fans or not. So it's a great one to have a discussion on. I appreciate being back on.
And my absolute pleasure, Brian. You're welcome back anytime. But before you sign off, you know, you said that everybody has an opinion. And that's true. And I have a few other opinions to share. Our buddy Jason Long, who I had on for Sad But True, and he's the guy who introduced us, so we owe him for this connection. But he commented on Facebook, he said, about The Unforgiven, "For me, it's a top 5 all-time Metallica song. Hetfield's lyrics are incredible. Blends a lot of what they do best with the acoustic intro. Heavier during the verses than you might think. Kirk's solo is his best, perfect, iconic." That comment's funny because I feel like it basically sums up this whole episode.
right. And taking away Jason, way to wrap it up.
And then on Flick Chat, which I mentioned before, Paul writes, "Great song. Kirk's solo kicks ass. My only negative, my sister started liking them."
That's funny. That's funny.
And then Ralph, who I love Ralph, Brian. I'm not sure if you've had much interaction with him on the Flick Chat app, but he's always down to talk Metallica and music, and he always leaves me a really great thought-out comment. So he says, "After listening to the first 3 songs in the album, I had definitely figured out that my band had truly changed. But after hearing this track, it was definitely clear that they were breaking away from the thrash metal world. First, there was that weird horn intro. And then there was the soft acoustic guitar. Not unheard of in the metal world, but something still seemed far different here. Once I heard the vocals, though, I was really blown away as James Hetfield was actually singing in a clean voice. There was no screaming, barking of the lyrics on this song. I remember being so shocked that I almost fell off my bed. This was certainly a departure from the norm, but it was absolutely amazing. Eventually, I got to the, quote, guitar player of the year solo from the Ripper Kirk Hammett that takes you on an amazing soaring journey. By song's end, I was completely bowled over. This song is a masterpiece. I think most would now agree that it is a Metallica classic for sure."
No doubt. No doubt.
Hard to argue with all that. This is truly... you know, the Black Album is a classic album. It is one of the biggest albums of all time. And The Unforgiven is a classic song and one of the biggest metal songs of all time.
No doubt. The biggest song on the biggest album for the biggest band. What a great thing to be part of a conversation.
Absolutely. So, Brian, thank you so much again for joining us. Do you want to plug the Metallica Collectors group on Facebook for anybody who might be interested?
Sure. Why? Metallica Collectors, not Metallica Collectors page on Facebook, join us. You've got to answer some questions so we know you're not a bot and you want to participate. Over 10,000 people. There's buying, selling, trading, just conversation about pieces all the time. Lots of cool shit goes up. So if you have any Metallica collecting interests or just want to see what's out there, definitely sign up for it.
And if you're interested in collecting or you just want to hear some really cool Metallica stories you've not heard Brian on episode 19 yet, again, go back and check that out. He has just one-of-a-kind items. When you hear what he has, you're going to be like, how is that in his house and not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
This is true. And I think I got like a whopping like 3 new Facebook friends from people that heard my podcast with you. So that was pretty cool. People,
sweet.
No, and I don't think any of them were from America either.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that I'm so ignorant that I always talk about things as if everybody's an American who lives on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, a lot of people listen in other countries or at the very least are like on the West Coast or, you know, you're on Central Time, so.
Yeah, I think that's the most amazing thing was I was shocked to hear people from around the world that replied to me and sent me a message saying they listened to that. I mean, how cool is that? So for you,
cool.
with the reach of your show, and then for me, for people that heard about my passion for collecting. And, I was floored the other day when somebody even quoted one of the things that I said on the podcast in a chat at the Metallica Collectors site. So, yeah.
That is awesome.
Hello to everybody that is not in the Midwest of the United States of America. How about that?
I second that. Please follow Metallicast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm at MetallicastPod on all three. I'm trying to come up with as many ways as possible to get the Metallicast Militia to interact with me, whether that be on social media. On Facebook, there's also Metallica Militia group, but I honestly rarely use that. But there's several people in there that post a lot of random shenanigans in there. To substitute that group, I really want Flick Chat to get off the ground. I think it's a really cool forum to talk with like-minded people. And like I said, there's only a handful of us in there, but we're all really digging in, I think, and we're all having a really good conversation. So download that app for free on your phone. Use the code Metallicast, and you'll be part of the group. You can also always email the podcast, metallicast@fans.experts.com. And you can, of course, always leave a voicemail at the Metallicast hotline, 203-548-0609. It is a Google number. It is so you can use your phone, you can use your desktop, whatever you're comfortable doing. I will not answer, but it will go to a voicemail, and I'll be more than happy to share anything you write or say on the air. And you know, if you have a podcast of your own or a Twitter handle, whatever you want to plug, I got no problem doing that. Please download, subscribe, and leave a positive review for the podcast. Let's get these numbers growing. I feel like I'm the little Metallica podcast that can. You know, I got some big competition out there, Brian.
You're the real deal right there.
Oh, thank you. As always, I want to end with a cover. Now, I did something a little bit different for this episode. I put a poll on Twitter. I was doing research for Unforgiven covers, and as you might expect, Brian, there are just dozens upon dozens of different covers out there of this song.
Dude, I just saw talking about Metallica covers for one second, I just saw that Sum 41 just covered like 5 Metallica songs this week.
Yeah. Yeah, they did that as part of it was like an in-studio SiriusXM thing. I listened to it this morning. It was pretty tight.
Right, not bad.
Yeah, not too bad. It reminded me of a handful of episodes ago, I talked with Richard S.E. about MTV Icon, and they started off that show, and they kind of did like a similar medley as they did for SiriusXM. But, you know, that's a band that's not really my they're not a band I would seek out to listen to, but they're a tight band, and I love that they wear their influences on their sleeves, you know?
No doubt about it.
So to kind of help me narrow down covers, you know, I just did a poll. four genres of music. Do you want to hear The Unforgiven as a metal song, as a Gregorian chant song? Yes, that does exist. As a classical song, which there are tons of versions of out there, piano covers, cello versions, you know, from Apocalyptica and others, as well as a reggae version, which I was expecting to hate because I'm really not into reggae, but actually was pretty cool. And that was, it's not a strict cover. The lyrics of the verses are different. But the overall vibe of the song's there, the chorus is there. So it's kind of like a cover slash sample. But no surprise here, Brian. Metal won out. Who would have thought that metalheads would vote for metal?
Shocker.
But 48% voted for a metal cover of The Unforgiven. So I chose what I think is a very metal cover. It's from Metal Hammer's A Tribute to Metallica's Black Album. This is a German band called Dark Age. So here they are with their cover of The Unforgiven. Join me next week as Metallica's Black Summer rolls on with Part 5, Wherever I May Roam. And I'm going to be joined with another guest who I'm very excited about because he's a good buddy of mine and the co-host of another podcast that I'm getting off the ground for those of you who are into more extreme metal or into drinking games. This will be a good podcast for you to check out. It's called the Course Paid Podcast, and it's on everywhere you can find Metallicast, Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, and of course our home site, fans.experts.com. So until next time, ladies and gentlemen, metal up your ass.
Rock on, motherfucker. Later.
Yeah!
We interrupt this podcast to let you know that the Black Album is still not on the Billboard 200. Metallica has reported that sales have rapidly declined since Brandon launched Metallica's Black Summer a few weeks ago. On the bright side, experts credit Metal Up Your Podcast for having Hardwired to Self-Destruct still in the Billboard 200. Though, because Brandon mentioned it on Metallica's last week, those sales did dip a little bit as well. And if he keeps on mentioning it, we fully expect that it will be completely out of the Billboard 200 by next week. We now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast.
This fight he cannot win. I'm tired, man, they say. Not experts.